I saw the new Jerusalem city, long and deep as it was wide, coming down out of heaven, beautiful and holy, prepared to be God's bride. Well, there's no more crying in the city, and no more death or pain. Everything's made new, it's the gospel truth, and all the old things have passed away. Can you help me now? Oh, what a beautiful city. Oh, what a beautiful city, God told. It's a beautiful city. 12 gates to the city. Hallelujah.
Welcome to episode 47 of the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Coming to you
live from high atop the Mellow Mushroom here in downtown Metropolitan Franklin, Tennessee.
Oh, yeah.
Nate Larkin, sitting in here with engineer extraordinaire Mondo Grimes, and a special guest soon to be revealed. And joining us live from across the continent, from Studio B in San Luis Obispo, California, Aaron Porter. Hello, Aaron.
You almost forgot my name just then.
It's awful.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It feels good to be Studio A again.
Yeah.
We've been B for a while because you've had all the guests, Aaron, and I've been by myself, and Nate's been on the beach and
in a Speedo lounger in the sun.
Get used to it, folks. There's going to be more. As long as it's cold in Tennessee, Nate will be seeking warmer climes.
More Studio B in Franklin coming in the near future.
But here for a white Christmas, man! Yeah. What a great holiday we had. Yeah. How about you, Mona?
Awesome, man! It was awesome. I mean, sitting in the house and your PJs with the family, drinking coffee all day.
Oh yeah,
all day.
Yeah, because because with little ones, we woke up at like 5 a.m. So to stay present,
yeah,
I'm sure we'll talk about later. Stay present, I need a lot of caffeine. So it was awesome, man. It was great. It was gifts galore. It was incredible, man. So we had a really good time. So
we did too. And I'm now at the age where I'm the grandpa now.
Oh yeah.
I am the senior generation in the Larkin clan, which means I don't have to drive anymore on Christmas. They come to me, and they bring the grandkids.
So
we had a house full of kids and grandkids and a few extra guests. And
awesome.
Allie,
you know,
cooked
Nate,
up both a turkey and a ham.
I think you just need to shut up, because I think my mom subscribed to this, and now that they're grandparents and I have the kids, we make everyone come to our house. So I really don't think you need to keep talking like this. It's not doing anybody any favors at all. Okay, so, go ahead. Allie cooked something.
Well, yes, a ham, a turkey, all the trimmings, just an enormous put-you-to-sleep kind of dinner.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And for Christmas, my son converted the extra refrigerator out in the shed to a kegerator.
Mm.
Oh, brother.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
We're now drinking with gas, if you know what I mean. Yeah. It's excellent. And he gave me, I've got a regular brewery tap on it, but he also gave me the tap, which I've yet to install, for Guinness, which needs nitrous in addition to CO2. For those of you who are into the fermented adult drinks,
so Mondo was having the church approved moral drug, caffeine,
right,
and you were playing the part of the Presbyterian again.
That's right. I was. And I also had some caffeine. Beer, anti-beer. some of that wonderful coffee that we brought home from Belize. Did I send you any of that, Aaron?
You didn't, but I don't drink coffee, so I'd appreciate it and not drink it.
I thought maybe you'd have coffee with your seafood. Because Aaron doesn't
inside,
eat seafood.
Inside
either.
Jokes don't work so well on the radio.
So did you have a white Christmas in the Central Coast of California?
I spread some flour on the carpet in the living room. It was awesome. took some white out, painted the children's faces with it. It was a white Christmas, baby. We had rain last week. Huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Man, you guys have been, there's been lots of rain out there, hasn't there? Or are you not getting hit the way L.A. is?
Uh, I, I heard we got like 10 inches, which our annual average is 12 inches. So it was good. I don't know.
Okay. No mudslides?
No. It's been cold. I mean, okay. It's gotten down to like mid-50s. So that's why I'm wearing my beanie this morning. We're freezing here. It's a cold snap.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about you, but I didn't make the local Samson meeting last Monday.
Well, hold on. You guys both got to talk about Christmas.
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting here with the best Christmas ever because I got my second to the oldest son a Red Ryder BB gun this year.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My oldest son was not jealous because he got lots of Legos, and I can appreciate that, but that was not nearly as cool as and he is not a subscriber because he thinks Santa brought it, although this year he's starting to suspect there is no Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, he kept disappearing all day out to the porch. It was raining and just shooting anything out there, shooting neighbors, shooting animals from the porch with his Red Ryder BB gun.
Oh, man.
And that movie was a big part of our life because I looked exactly like that kid when I was that age.
Like Ralphie?
Ralphie. I was a Ralphie duplicate, so all our extended family would watch it and laugh and call me Ralphie.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, I don't know, there's something about giving your son a firearm as a young man and watch him do some damage. It's good.
I don't know what it is about that air rifle. To me, that's like the best. Yeah, it's the most prized possession I think of my entire life. I lived with that thing, slept with that thing as a kid, and you know went everywhere they would allow me to carry it, and couldn't wait to buy one for my son. My oldest son couldn't have cared less. I bought him one and he put it in the closet because what he really wanted was stereo headphones. but my second son took to it the way I did. Something primal, at least for some of us,
about
being armed and dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some aspect of fallenness in there, but it's still awesome.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk about, we'll talk about something really, really cool, and then we'll introduce the guest. And we got an awesome guest for this.
We're talking about 48 Hours of Frankness coming back. We've got a lot of options for guys. And we will be right back on the Pirate Mom Podcast.
Okay.
Welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast. That little snippet of Hoedown Beauty was from our special guest.
Hoedown Beauty.
And
okay, that was wheel
so many
horse
comments that could be made.
Okay, all right.
See, watch my filter work right now. Hold on. There it is. I mean, it's hard to watch a filter, but I will give this hint. He was the man on the harmonica blazing the blow harp. Blow harp.
Bodacity.
Well, whatever. He was blow harp Bodacity, and there you go. That was his voice. That's a double hint. If you don't know it by now, you are a toothless hillbilly. No, wait. If you do know it by now, you are a toothless hillbilly.
Okay.
Darn, we just lost our toothless hillbilly demographic.
Right. Or a Bill Gator groupie. All right. So what do we got coming up in Samson World?
Man, we have our pastor 48 hours retreat, which we've been making phone calls. We've had our local pastor pirates calling pastors all over the state, and they did it with such a great attitude as well. By the way, this is for any of them that actually listen to this. Really appreciate the good attitude that they hit the phones with. That was sarcasm. I don't know if that comes through on the air.
Right.
But in case you can't smell it there in Tennessee, And we're gonna experiment. This is really the first full blown 48 hours for pastors we've done, and we're retooling some stuff. And Nate will be there. Scott Dente will be there. I think we should figure out how to get Mondo out there, just as as an added benefit. But anyways,
I think so. Yeah. I think the Mondo's got to come.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay.
The Mondo, yes, the Mojo Movement Man.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's coming up end of January up in the San Bernardino Mountains. That's going to be great. And then you have a couple other 48 hours as well, right, Nate?
Well,
at least one.
Yeah, at least one I'm going to. That'll be the one put on by the Palatka Pirates in Palatka, Florida, not too far from St. Augustine. That'll be the first weekend in February.
Now, real quick, do you have to alliterate to be a pirate monk with the Pastor Pirates and the Palatka Pirates? There might be people in, like, Saskatchewan that are insecure about being Saskatchewan pirates. Is that okay?
Yes, I suppose. I mean, they're second-class pirates if they can't find some way to incorporate alliteration into the name. But still, we allow them on the boat.
Well, I'll just say this to you in Saskatchewan. If you put a P in front of an S, it's silent. So you could go ahead and put a P in front of the S, and you'd probably be at least halfway there. Go ahead, Nate. Tell us more about this 48 hours of frankness.
And you interrupted me for that? actually, and then there's other stuff that's kind of, you know, Samson-friendly. Great men's stuff. Now, next weekend, our guest, I'll go ahead and tell you, it's Buddy Green. He's going to be doing a New Year's celebration at Laity Lodge in Lakey, Texas. And the weekend after that, the first full weekend of the new year, he and I will be together doing a men's retreat there. And I'm really looking forward. I'm going to go ahead and ask Buddy to jump in on this and tell us a little bit about Laity Lodge down there in Lakey, Texas, because it's a special place to you, and I'd love our pirate monks to know about it.
Well, it is a special place. It's out in the hill country, out in the middle of nowhere. As you would tell, the nearest town being Lakey.
Mm-hmm. Spelled Leaky, by
Leaky,
the way.
Leaky, yeah, that's right. It's not far from Kerrville, which is not far from San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get there, you're really sort of cut off from the outside world, which is a good thing. And you actually go through you have to ride through a riverbed to get to the...
Wow.
To the facility. And then once you're there, you might as well just turn off the cell phone, because nothing reaches there.
Mm.
And then it's just a matter of getting used to that to that sort of existence in this days of instant communication and all that. But it really just works to chill you down.
Mm-hmm.
And then the place is sort of dedicated to chilling out and being at a real retreat where you're relaxing, meeting some people, usually hearing some great speakers, music.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great emphasis on the arts there, so there's always an artist in residence that might be teaching anything from pottery to painting.
Mm.
And there's the activities include it's on the Frio River, which cuts a canyon through the property, and it's this great river for canoeing, swimming.
Wow.
There's hiking all around. There's tennis, and, you know, so there's lots of activities like that, and food is great.
I understand the facilities are spectacular.
Yeah, they really are. And it's all attributed to the Howard Butt family, who are the people who started the HEB grocery chain out there.
Okay, that's a big chain in Texas.
Howard E. Butt
is
what that HEB stands for.
Yeah, I'd go by HEB too.
Well, Howard Butt Jr.,
uh-huh.
who is now probably in his 80s, is the heir of all this and also the sort of guiding force behind it. It was his parents who started this place back around 1960. And at this time, they already had around 2,000 acres of property out there that was dedicated to camping for inner city kids who never got a chance to go out outside of the urban life. And so they were sending kids out there all the time, what they call free camps, because they would basically just give the facility away and people would bring their own camp contingency out there.
Yeah,
set
yeah.
up. And that still goes on today. And now I think some 20-something thousand kids a year go through the through the camps out there.
Wow.
And so the retreat facility is really something just to create awareness of what's going on out there, but also to give a real haven for retreats for everybody, from private groups to churches to annual events like the men's retreat that I'll be doing with you.
Mm-hmm.
And this coming weekend is a special one with it's a New Year's Eve retreat, and Eugene Peterson. Who wrote the message, the great paraphrase of the Bible.
Do we say wrote the message or just say finessed the message?
You know? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he gave his take on it.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So still written by God and finessed by Eugene. All right, okay, just checking.
Right. Channeled by Eugene. Yeah, there you go.
Oh,
I don't know, that's probably wrong too, isn't it?
Yeah, that's dangerous, but all right.
I don't know. Just listening to y'all's conversation before, I felt like anything went here.
Oh, it does. It absolutely does, yeah.
Oh, anything goes, but you'll be called on it. That's all.
It won't be the first time. Anyway, Eugene and his wife Jan will be there, and my wife's going with me. This speaks a lot about Laity Lodge. I think it's one of about two places in all of my 25 years of traveling as a solo artist that my wife has actually wanted to accompany me.
Yeah.
Everything, you know, Peoria, she'll just let me do all those on my own. But
yeah,
going to someplace like Laity, I remember the first time she went out there with me, very skeptical about going, you know, tagging along with me where I was going to be working. But by Sunday morning, when we had this, every experience always ends with a communion service out there. And by that time, as we sat around and talked about what the weekend had meant, my wife actually spoke up. I mean,
wow.
I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
She's usually the quiet, retiring, you know, back pew Methodist.
Yeah.
But she was, you know, she actually raised her hand and intoned her praises and thanksgiving for being there. So it was great.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I love that Eugene Peterson is going to be there the weekend before I am. Maybe we could say that Eugene Peterson is opening for me. Could we say that?
We'll say that here now, if you'd like.
That, or we can just say the guy that thought the Bible wasn't good enough that had to rewrite it.
Oh.
So you can go either way with that. You know, it sounds like it's a beautiful place, and that's great. And they help kids that can't afford camp, and that's important. But I think the most beautiful and important thing about it is that they've triple alliterated with the Laity Lodge in Leakey, Texas.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most beautiful thing.
Triple
that makes them most important. Triple alliteration. That makes them super pirates.
Well, before we launch into our interview with Buddy Green, how about we play the title cut off his CD, A Few More Years, the one that Vince Gill sings on. Is that it?
Yeah, play a little bit.
Here it is. Anyways.
A few more seasons come, and we shall be with those that rest, asleep within the tomb. Then soul for that great day.
And we're back with our special guest of the day, Buddy Green, a man who is approaching YouTube immortality. With that clip of you playing the William Tell Overture on the harmonica at Carnegie Hall, how many? 1.7 looks or something like that?
Yeah, that's a lot.
1.7 million?
Approaching a couple mil.
1.7, not so impressive. But 1.7
million? Yeah.
Yeah. Because the 0.7 is the guy that watched half of it and turned it off, right? So that's not. That's not that great.
Yeah, of course, I've seen you do that live a couple of times, and it just never ceases to blow me away.
You know, it landed me a gig on Craig Ferguson's show.
That's right!
I mean, a dubious gig, but a gig nonetheless.
Yeah.
Wait, can you say that again? It landed me a gig on Craig Ferguson's show. I just want to hear it one more time.
Yeah. It landed me a gig on the Craig Ferguson show, and I got to wear a blue lamé that night. That was
fantastic.
That was a career first.
So. I would like to I'd like to hear some of your story.
Okay.
I don't know a ton about your story. I know that you didn't grow up in church. At least
Actually,
I think
I did.
You did.
I did grow up, but I wandered away.
See, I don't know your story at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. give us a sketch.
Okay. Well, I did grow up in church, being born in Georgia.
Oh, okay.
White and born in Georgia. I was a Southern Baptist. I was either Baptist or Methodist.
Yeah.
And so as I grew up there, it was also in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That so that was kind of a turbulent period of Vietnam, civil rights, all that stuff going on.
Sure.
And so that was my coming of age period. And also I was into music at a very early age, from time I can remember. To it really took hold fast when I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, like so many other guys my age. And I was too little to play football, so it was like, give me that ukulele and I'll see what I can do. And
well, can you go ahead and say that again as well? I was too little to play football, so give me that ukulele and I'll see what I can do. Actually, I went ahead and go on. Go on. That's all right.
Yeah, and actually it was that. My first band was with me and two other guys playing ukuleles, and then quickly we found a guy who would play bongos, and we called ourselves the Flying Beatles. We were a 10-year-old
that's
sensation.
That's awesome. That
wow.
is awesome.
Yeah.
I don't think that's awesome. Hey, man. I think that's just funny.
Yeah.
Were you guys good, though? If you tell me you're good, I'll believe you. Bongos and two ukuleles.
Hey, let me tell you. Wait a minute, Aaron. Now you scoff, but listen to this. It's better than that. I learned my first few chords on this ukulele before I discovered the Beatles a few mm-hmm. months earlier when mm-hmm. my older sister had discarded her ukulele
right.
after camp.
Right. You
know? So she taught me the three chords she knew, and I started learning If I Had a Hammer and 500 Miles, all the folk songs of early 60s. Then the Beatles hit the thing, and of course that's rock and roll.
Yeah.
And so then it was rock and roll with three chords, though. So, you know, I saw her standing there.
Yeah.
She loves you.
None
of that was a
problem.
On the ukulele.
Yeah.
And so I decided, man, somebody's got to hear this. You know, this is too good to keep to myself.
Right, yeah.
So one day there was a local drugstore with a soda fountain.
Uh huh.
And one day I just sort of sauntered nonchalantly into that drugstore with the ukulele in hand and went back and sat down on a stool there at the uh-huh. soda fountain, uh-huh. you know, just waiting for anybody to say, so what can you do with that thing?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, in just a matter of moments that happened, and before they could get away I was up and singing, you know, She Loves You or something like
that.
Then the druggist, the pharmacist, he comes out of there because the crowd's coming back there,
right,
and it's helping business. He says, give this young man a milkshake.
Oh.
And
your first paying gig.
I've never been the same since, Aaron. Never got over that experience. So that's how it all began for me.
Wow.
Yeah, that's, I can see why I even got over it. That's the most traumatic story I've ever heard on this podcast. Druggists and ukuleles and Beatles covers.
That's right.
It's all fitting together.
Well, it got bad for the druggist because I started bringing friends uh-huh. With me. We became a duet, then a trio, and then a quartet.
The milkshake expenses rose.
And then finally he said, you know, you should probably go down to the to the barbershop. I think they give away bubblegum.
Wow. So this is the, for all those who are young and in bands, go ahead and start gigging at the pharmacy, then move to the barbershop, and eventually you'll be at Carnegie Hall. That's what you've learned here on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Yeah, and as downloading ensues, I'll be back at the pharmacy.
That's
here,
right,
before
exactly.
That'll be a really good gig before you know it.
Yeah. Now, I know you, and everybody around here knows you as a folk artist and a gospel artist. Did you have a rock and roll phase? I mean, did you actually play rock and roll professionally?
Yeah, in high school.
In high school,
band, I mean, those ukuleles gave way to guitars really soon, mm-hmm. and drums. And
did you ever go electric? I've never seen you on electric.
Yeah, we did, actually. Yeah? Because, you know, all the music, everybody was playing, you know, the British Invasion and Motown and all the soul stuff. It was really, you know, needed to have a good electric guitar and play all that stuff. So, you know, we were doing cover material of all that, that stuff in the late 60s.
Yeah.
And it was fun. Yeah. But by the time I got to college is when the sort of acoustic roots thing started happening. Mm-hmm. I got really interested in what was informing popular music, which, you know, blues and country and all that stuff.
Yeah. When did you pick up the harmonica? When did that start?
About that same time.
Really?
College years, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. I was hearing more and more of it on. I mean, everybody played it a little bit. You know, the Rolling Stones or even mm-hmm. the Beatles early mm-hmm. on. You know, would have some harmonica. But when I started hearing the really cool blues guys, I mean, the Allman Brothers, live at Fillmore East, they had this guy named Tom Duchette, I think, who sat in with them. He was a really great player. And then I started hearing people like Paul Butterfield and. Mm. So it made me pull out my old harmonica. I think I'd gotten one 10 years earlier and didn't know what to do with it. So I went and found it, pulled it out. And I don't know, I just discovered a couple of things right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And that hooked me. And then it was just sort of obsession after that.
Wow.
So what was the... I mean, harmonica is an interesting instrument, sort of like bass, in that it's really easy to be a bad harmonica player.
Right.
I mean, Bob Dylan's proved that you don't really have to ever learn how to play the harmonica to play it your entire career.
Yeah, it's good for
effect. And then, but then the jump between, like, I blow on this to doing what you do, what was that process?
Well, it was hearing those guys that were masters, you know. Mm-hmm. Once I heard something that was beyond that limited... Mm-hmm. You know, even like John Lennon, the stuff he did was real basic, but it was effective. So was Bob Dylan's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But when you hear, you know, by the time I heard people just playing really sophisticated stuff on the harmonica,
mm-hmm.
it just intrigued me so much. And it was, it wasn't just blues artists either. Charlie McCoy, who's one of the greatest all-time country stylists, he really captured my interest because he was taking that little 10-hole instrument and playing... you know, beautiful melodies on it, and he could play blues, he could play country, he could play pop, all this stuff on this one little instrument, which had been sort of stereotyped to either be campfire or just a blues instrument. So once I started realizing that there was a lot to be discovered on the instrument, then I was just off and running.
Wow.
Yeah, and it really is a matter of just being inspired.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's why great guitar players... You know, if you talk to anybody who's a great instrumentalist, whatever, they're always just talking about their influences, you know, whether it's, you know, Clapton, B.B. King, or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They've got their heroes, and that's what's fueled the fire all along.
Real quick, because, Nate, you already know Buddy, and, you know, you told me, like, 45 minutes before this started that Buddy was going to be our guest, so I quickly typed in Buddy Guy and learned all about the blues musician.
Buddy Guy,
and then he showed
week.
Up.
Yeah,
and then he's white, and I'm confused. And so there might be some people that don't know Buddy Green's work. By the way, that's Green with an E, which Nate did say, and I thought
actually
there's
three
two E's.
There's
two E's, dude. So that took me a while to realize you meant a last one. So if you want to look up Buddy, make sure Green at the end. Give us some reference, because I want to get more into your story, but I want people to know that they actually do know you, because I was surprised to find out a couple things. They know you through Mary Did You Know, for sure,
right?
That's probably that So tell us some things, or Nate, you can tell us some things that people would actually realize they knew Buddy from. So the song "Mary, Did You Know?"
Mary, Did You Know? Which you wrote with Mark.
With Mark Lowry, yeah. I wrote the music, and he wrote the lyrics.
Wow.
And that was 20 years ago, practically.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's been so. A few years before that is when I started playing, doing solo work. I mean, I became a recording artist in my own right. And leading up to that time, I had left sort of the world of bars and playing the Georgia circuit to come up to Nashville as a member of Jerry Reed's band.
Yeah.
And Jerry Reed was a great country music entertainer, and I was a
huge
fan of
his.
We got
us a convoy.
Yeah. No, he was not the convoy guy.
Oh, that's right. He wasn't the convoy guy. He was in the movie.
But he was
the
in the movie with. He drove the truck in the Burt Reynolds movie.
Right, exactly.
Smokey and the Bandit.
Oh, come on now. Give me a. I know.
So a Jerry
know.
Reed song would be When You're Hot, You're Hot.
When You're
Amos
Hot, You're
Moses,
Hot. Oh, When You're Hot, You're Hot.
Eastbound and Down, Loaded Up and Trucking.
Right, yeah.
On and on. He was a great entertainer and songwriter. He wrote Guitar Man for Elvis. He wrote A Thing Called Love that Elvis recorded. And, anyway, he was on the Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour way back.
Oh, yeah.
He's a great personality. Another guy from, he was from Georgia, and so he had this southern, folksy, fun kind of personality. And he was also one of the greatest guitar players that this town ever saw. And very innovative and influencing people like Chet Atkins and others.
Really?
So that was a great tutelage to have for you know, 4 years, and as I traveled around with him, and it sort of set the stage for me to kind of do my own thing. I was I was writing. By the time I finished that gig, I was ready to do something. And a fellow named Bob McKenzie gave me a record deal. It was that went along with my new faith. By this time, I had come to Christ at around age 30, so this was a 2 or 3 years into that process that that I met Bob, and he knew that I was a new believer, that I had started writing gospel songs that were not like the typical you know, contemporary Christian or even Southern gospel. It was Southern, but all the influences were coming from places like blues and bluegrass and things like that. It was totally unmarketable, is actually what but it was interesting. And also Bob was a very good friend of Bill Gaither.
Yeah.
Bob had produced Bill, the Bill Gaither Trio and scads of other gospel acts when he was involved with Benson Records. So he and Bill were really about best friends, and he introduced us. And Bill liked me for the same reasons Bob did, and wanted to introduce me to his audience. So I started going out with him, and that was really my introduction into Christian music.
Sure.
Yeah, and now it's 25 years later, and I'm still as unknown as ever.
No,
Aaron is a good case in point there.
Well, yeah, but you have your audience. I've told you this. I've got an uncle, you know, that who's now, I guess he's in his 70s. Who, you know, heard that I moved to Nashville, and you know, he wanted to know if there were any artists around, and so I started slinging off the names of the, you know, the top country artists and the Christian artists that live around here, and he just sat there and nodded until I said Buddy Green, and he came out of his chair.
Yeah, and he's what, 80?
Nate, I don't feel like you've actually helped this argument at all there. I'm taking sides with Buddy right now.
This isn't uncle who he's the Christian equivalent of a deadhead. It actually follows Bill Gaither around in the Winnebago.
Those are my most avid fans.
Yeah.
Are the ones who are, you know, 70, 80 years old.
Yeah.
And I mean if I play anywhere, usually there'll be some young kid that'll come up, and I'll get my head starts to swell just a little bit, because they'll come up and go, "Hey, I just really like your music. Hey, would you sign this CD for my grandfather?"
but hey, buddy, you know what? Complaining aside, they don't know how to download music. So really, you're still going to make money off of them.
Yeah, that's true. They're the last group out there that will actually buy a CD. So I'm really thankful to have them as my audience.
Of course, they put it on their record player, and that's a problem. But
no, let me tell you, this is a true story. This happened 2 or 3 years ago. You've been on Steve Brown's show before. So you know Steve. He's this author, former preacher, good friend of mine, and we've done a lot of work together in retreats and conferences and things like that. And usually I'm just getting up, preparing the way with a song or two, and then he gets up and pontificates like Presbyterians do.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And so I was at this retreat with him somewhere in like West Virginia, and it was like the second day, and everybody there was 45 and older.
Sure.
Except for a few hapless teenagers who had to be brought along because their parents didn't know what to do with them that
right,
weekend.
Right, right, right.
So there's really literally two or three kids there, and they were just so bored. I mean, they hated the whole thing. But I was walking out in the hall after I'd played my obligatory songs, and Steve was in there teaching. I'm getting a cup of coffee. I see this kid come walking up. He's got his iPod going. He sees me, and he pulls down the... He goes, "Hey, you're that guy that was up there playing." I said, "Yeah." He says, "Dude, you're awesome. Man, that harmonica playing, that was fantastic. How long you been playing the harmonica?" I said, "About 30 years. He went, "Wow, that was fantastic. And then guitar playing, man, you were like finger picking and flat picking and just doing stuff. Man, that's really great. How long you been playing?" I said, "About 40 years. He went, "Wow, dude, that was great. And those songs... I never heard those songs. Those are great songs. Did you write those songs?" I said, "Yeah, I wrote a lot of them." He says, "Man, those, dude, you're awesome. Why aren't you successful?"
Wow. Well, I think with that, we're going to come back with the rest of the story between touring with a famous guy being a rocker and in the middle of that you coming to Christ, because I want to hear that story. But first, we're going to hear another song from Buddy Guy. From Buddy Green, here on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Be careful how you encourage a harmonica player. Thank you.
So, wow. Buddy, what in the world possessed you to learn to play the William Tell Overture on the harmonica?
Desperation. You know, when you're a harmonica player playing bars in Georgia, you'll just do anything for attention, you know. I mean, really, it's the plight of every bar band.
Oh, sure.
You know, you're up there being taken for granted. Nobody's really paying attention. Mm-hmm. And so I was a part of this little trio. We called ourselves Uncle Ernie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great guitar player, a friend of mine. I played mostly harmonica, and then we had a bass player.
Mm-hmm.
And we were always trying to come up with, you know, showstoppers.
Right.
So, like, Orange Blossom Special or
yeah.
any of these things like that. It would just sort of, you know, bring a drunk crowd to their feet.
Yeah.
And
off the floor into their feet.
That's right.
Yes.
Right. And so one week, I was living outside of town in Macon, Georgia. And I had two or three days before the next gig, and I just remember thinking about the Lone Ranger. I just remember that one day, and I was, because I stumbled across the, you know, just that, I started doing that on the harmonica.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, I wonder if I could reconstruct that in any capacity, you know, on this harmonica. So I just started, I mean, strictly from memory, trying to do this thing. And so, of course, what I came up with was this really truncated, bastardized version of what Rossini actually wrote.
Yeah.
But at the end of the process, it was pretty impressive. I mean, here I was on a 10-hole harmonica, and within 3 or 4 days, I had it down to where I called up my bandmates and said, hey, man, we got to get together. I got the perfect showstopper for this weekend.
Yeah.
We worked it up, and, you know, the first time we did it, the place, you know, just brought the house down.
Sure.
So
yeah.
After that, it ended practically every set.
Yeah.
That we would do. We'd do at least once a night. And so that was, gosh, 1980 or something like that.
Wow.
And when I started going out with Bill on the road with him, I was doing a couple of songs off my record. And I was getting good crowd appeal and everything. And he said, so what else have you got? You know, and I had this one album. That was it. And so I said, well, you know, I've got some stuff I hadn't recorded, like, some fun stuff on the harmonica.
Mm-hmm.
Let me hear that. So I played him the William Tell Overture, and he just went crazy.
Yeah.
He said, oh, we got to do that next show.
Yeah, yeah.
So we did it, and it brought the house down. So not only does it work on drunk bargoers in Georgia, it works on churchgoers and Bill Gaither's.
Oh, that's universal. You know what? That's sort of like the gospel. It works on Christians and drunk bargoers.
That's a very good analogy.
We need our listeners to understand that. Yeah, I think that's great. Thanks for that. So, okay, you're on the road. So, you know what? We need to say that again. Christians, you need the gospel as much as the drunks. That's what we're saying. All right.
Exactly,
so, anyways.
What we're saying.
So you were on tour. And I want to get to this place that you're on tour with a famous guy,
Jerry Reed,
on the road, and then 2 years into that, you become a Christian. There's holes in that story.
I became a Christian right before I got the job with Jerry.
Okay.
I was in Macon, Georgia, and there'd been about a 3 or 4 year process of, you know, by my mid-20s, I'd made all these terrible decisions, rejected God and everything my parents stood for, you know, in high school, and over the next 10 years, it was just one bad choice after another.
Yeah.
And eventually married, divorced within about a year and a half. And in my mid-20s, I was just so downcast and, I mean, really sort of despairing over the way my life was turning out. And I started cracking open the Bible every once in a while. I was actually going to just sort of review all the world's religions and see if I could come up with some sort of spirituality that worked.
Yeah.
And I really didn't get any farther than, like, Matthew.
Yeah.
You know, I started reading the Bible for the first time as a thinking adult.
Yeah.
And, you know, I ran into Jesus, and I was totally attracted to this guy.
Yeah.
And then it's like, all right, let's see what Mark has to say, and Luke and John. And so I really just kind of went to the Gospels and started reading. There was a lot I didn't understand. And at the same time, not coincidentally, I start running into, you know, Christians in bars.
Nice.
You know, one of them actually invited me to his house for a Bible study that he had going, and there was a lot of riffraff there like me.
Yeah.
It actually kind of felt like an AA meeting. I mean, you showed up and everybody's smoking and drinking coffee, And then we'd wander into the next room, and there was this really straight-laced guy sitting there teaching the Bible. He was a church counselor at this Presbyterian church in Macon. And he was teaching the Gospel of John, and occasionally he'd flip over to Proverbs and teach a little bit from there.
Yeah.
And so I would just go home from these Bible studies, and they were weekly.
Yeah.
And I'd go home from there, and living by myself, and I just think about this stuff. And then I continued to make bad choices.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I was just coming under conviction.
And yeah.
So the part of the gospel that really started appealing to me early on was the part that God will help you, you know, internally.
Mm.
He'll start cleaning up you on the inside so that what's going on the outside starts to improve.
Yeah. An inside-out change rather than an outside-in.
Right. That's what I wanted.
Yeah.
Because all the stuff that I was trying to do on my own was just a sham,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, I was likable, and I had lots of friends, and everybody patted me on the back. But I knew what a hypocrite I was.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what a sinner I was.
Yeah.
And so, the fact I knew I needed forgiveness, but I also knew I needed help.
Yeah.
And so that's what I wanted a better life. I wasn't worried about heaven. I was worried about the hell I was in here now.
Mm.
And so I wanted to experience some heaven now.
Mm.
So you weren't so concerned about finding Jesus because you might die tomorrow, but because you were probably going to live.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, and this life that I was concocting was death.
That is, I love that. Because how many people come to Jesus and then pause right at the threshold of the door he's knocking on and try to clean the house?
Yeah.
And just yesterday at church, I was just teaching about the characters in the Nativity story. And, you know, we use words like manger. I hate the word manger. What a horrible word for a trough.
Yeah.
Like a trough. Why do we use the word manger that we don't use at any other place? You don't go to like a farm to take a tour, and they're like, and here is the manger that the cows eat from. Like, nobody uses the word manger except Christians with the nativity, because we want to clean up the trough.
Yeah.
We don't want to put Jesus in a trough. And the shepherds, I hate, you know that story about the shepherds were out watching the sheep, but they were watching the sheep that were going to be slaughtered at the Passover.
Yeah, right.
Because they were pious Jewish shepherds. It's like, what is wrong with you Christians that you have to clean up the story that God left purposefully dirty so that we could understand that God planned? I mean, here's the other thing. We have to understand God planned on all this, right? It wasn't like he's, oh my gosh, I made a reservation at the inn 3,000 years ago, and you gave my reservation away, and now there's no room at the inn. Like, that's the other option, or else God planned this. And so God makes his first step in sending his gift of the Son to the world in a dirty, filthy stable, in a dirty, filthy place, so that we could understand that Jesus is totally comfortable in dirty, filthy places.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no other reason, because the story has no bearing on the rest of Jesus' life.
Yeah.
Except that we understand step one is dirty and filthy.
Yeah.
And I think, man, if we could stop trying to clean up everything about Christianity, understand that God left it very messy and very dirty. I mean, I think that's amazing that you even had enough insight to understand that's what you needed.
Well, I think you have to get a little down and out, or maybe very down and out,
mm-hmm.
before you can maybe face up to that need you're talking about, Aaron. And I think people that go to church, it just naturally is sort of an anesthetic kind of experience.
Yeah.
Where you're not really facing up to reality. And if you're raised in it, where you're getting really good moral instruction and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to diss church, because I think I'm really glad I grew up in church. For one thing, stuff was getting planted in me.
Yeah.
And I remember when I started listening to those hymns that I learned as a little boy, and then mm-hmm. they actually meant something.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I was glad I knew those hymns were there. I knew I had they gave me something to sing praise and give thanks
mm-hmm.
with, and
mm-hmm.
to understand this theology without, you know, listening to a Presbyterian preacher. I could go listen to Charles Wesley or somebody like that, you know, do it in a song, and it really made my heart sing, you know.
Yeah.
But it is the same thing goes on in churches that went on with the Pharisees that it's always been a problem. That's what religion does. It gives us a way to sort of try to manipulate God and that's why I've always, or at least in the more that I follow Christ and the more that I study the gospel, I really see that one of the main things Jesus was doing was sort of an anti-religion
thing.
Mm-hmm. He was really coming into the face of all of that and saying, this is not about that. This is about a relationship with my Father. And that was what was so radical and revolutionary. And that's what I needed as a total down and outer, you know, looking for a way out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if we could change gears here and talk a little bit about where you are emotionally and spiritually now. You mentioned to me that this project, a few more years, is about a year old, did you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it came out in 2009.
Yeah. And it came out of life experience. You're now in your 50s. I'm in my 50s. How old are you?
I'm 57.
Okay, I'm 54, not far behind you.
Yeah. It doesn't get any better. Let me just say that up front.
Yeah. And getting to the point in my life where I'm starting to attend more funerals than weddings and facing up to my own mortality. And
yeah.
How's that working out? Give us a snapshot of where Buddy Green is right now in his spiritual journey.
You know, I wrote a little bit about this. Could I just read you a couple of paragraphs here? This is short. And it summed it up pretty well. I remember turning 50 a few years back with more than a little anxiety and self-pity. In the years that had followed that uneasy half-century feeling, the amount of stress, sorrow, and loss I've encountered has been much more than I bargained for. But misery loves company, and there's some solace that I'm not alone. Seems like everywhere I turn, people I care about are dealing with their own late midlife maelstroms. But music has been a great gift to me during this time, as I've recalled, discovered, and uncovered songs that have helped carry the gospel to my aching heart. This collection represents just some of those gospel carriers that have worked to sustain me through this difficult season. So, in a nutshell, that's what was going on here.
Yeah.
Is that music's a great gift for any number of reasons, but I found that you know, when you're having the blues, you really need to sing the blues.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then then I think you're ready to sort of hear some good news.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the good news is not a Pollyanna, varnishing over what's going mm-hmm. on. It's really pointing you to something that God has promised from the beginning, and that is that He will have this creation the way He's always wanted it,
mm-hmm.
and you're a part of that.
Yeah.
And then, so all of that stuff... just being reminded again of why I'm here. I remember one time Steve Brown, again, to refer to my friend, said, he was sort of screaming at this Presbyterian church from the pulpit, "Have you ever wondered why God saves you and just leaves you here?" You know?
Mm.
And it was sort of a rhetorical question. And he sat there for a minute. And of course, they were just, you know, stone faced Presbyterians looking back at him. And nobody was going to be charismatic enough to go, you know, yell out the answer. So he goes, "It's for them." And he just pointed to the windows. "It's for them. It's for what's outside this building here."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just to be reminded of that, you know, we're all a part of this suffering. In fact, we're being perfected through our suffering in mm-hmm. the same way Christ was.
Yeah.
And that God has brought us to life as believers in the gospel and left us here because we get to partner in what He's doing.
Mm.
You know, this and that's, you know, doing a good job for people. Learning how to mourn with people.
Yeah.
Learning how to come alongside of people, showing mercy, loving mercy, doing justice. It's all a great reason for being. It's a great reason for being here.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Oh, how those two things go together. I mean, when you said when we feel the blues, we need to sing the blues.
Yeah.
And I just immediately thought, how many of the Psalms could be categorized as blues songs?
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's a huge percentage. I would love to go through all of them and just categorize them by lyrical content.
Yeah.
But God is clearly showing us, like, all right, you're here. And when Paul says, be imitators of me as I'm an imitator of Christ, he's not saying because I'm perfect. He's saying, watch me fall and rise in grace. Watch me struggle. And it makes it struggling. If you can't sing the blues when you're blue, then you're not an evangelist. You're a liar.
That's right.
That's good.
I think it's like 70% of the things have of the Psalms have some blues content, lament is going on in there.
Yeah.
I think I was reading Psalm 88 the other day, and it's nothing but blues. It ends with like the last verse is just like, you know, death is my friend. I mean, it's just like just so bad.
Yeah.
And it leaves you just hanging there. There's no tidy answer. It's not even but I'll praise God. There's not even any of that.
Yeah.
It's just
this
really sucks. This is just so bad. I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, thank God for a psalm like Psalm 88. You know, I had a cousin last year who lost her husband to throat cancer. And that's one of the worst things to watch somebody die from.
Mm.
It's just a terrible thing. And she sat there and her children, and they nursed this guy to his death. And I didn't have anything to say to her,
mm-hmm.
except maybe Psalm 88.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And she's not one who's really wholeheartedly in on the gospel either. But I knew the best thing I could do with her was mourn with her.
Yeah.
That's kind of still where we are. And, you know, at some point, maybe we'll be able to sing the gospel together. But right now, we're singing the blues together.
Yeah. That is deep, and that is beautiful. Well, why don't we play a song off this CD that follows the themes we've been talking about?
Okay. Hey, you know, talking about the blues, there's an old Stephen Foster song on here called "Hard Times Come Again No More." You know that song?
I don't.
Really? Yeah, it's not like, you know, everybody thinks about him as Camp Town Races and Old Susanna and those songs that he wrote.
And that man was, by the way, I mean, he was the Elvis of his day, wasn't he? I mean, he was huge.
Well, he was, but he died penniless and alcoholic at age 37, I think.
Are you kidding?
Mm-mm. Yeah. I mean, he was the most successful songwriter of his day, but that was back before copyright laws and things like that. So he basically sold songs as he wrote them.
Really?
And he died, you know, penniless and alone.
By the way, I attended Stephen Foster Elementary School.
You did?
In New Brighton, Pennsylvania, named for there was a piano in the foyer of the elementary school that Stephen Foster himself had played on a visit to the school, apparently, or New Brighton or something. And weekly, all of the students, and I was in the first and second grade, would gather there, and we'd go up the stairs, and we'd fill the hallways, and the principal would play the sacred piano, and we would sing Swanee River. That has no bearing on anything,
I'm a huge Stephen Foster fan, and in fact, there was a great documentary that came out on him 2 or 3 years ago, and you can still find, you know, video copies of this thing, and on Netflix or whatever. But
yeah.
It's a fascinating life to study. But he wrote this song called "Hard Times Come Again No More" the year that both of his parents died and his marriage started falling apart. And so it was a painful year. And I think it's one of the best songs about just identifying with the suffering of the world around you that I've ever heard. So I had to put it on this record. And I've started playing it a good bit in concert. It always gets a strong response from people. So, I mean, as far as a lament, this is the best that this album has to offer. "Hard Times Come Again No More."
Okay, this is from Buddy Green's CD, "A Few More Years."
Let us pause in life's pleasure and count its many tears while we all sup sorrow with the Lord. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis the song, the sigh of the weary. Hard times, come again, O Lord. For many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times, come again, no more. While we seek mirth and beauty and music, light and gay, there are frail forms fainting at the door. Though their voices are silent, though their pleading looks will say, oh, hard times, come again no more. 'Tis the song, the sigh, you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times, come again no more.
All right, welcome back again to the Pirate Monk podcast. We've got Buddy Green here with us visiting. Buddy, how can people get more information or get some music if they want to hear more Buddy Green? Give us like the illegal download addresses and the legal so that they can be in that moral conundrum and make a Jesus kind of choice.
They can go officially, they can go to my website, buddygreen.com, E on the end of green, and learn more than they ever wanted to know about me right there, probably. And we have Buddy's Mercantile is up and ready for business at all times, so we can process all your credit cards and anything right there. But also, there's a lot of stuff on YouTube.
Yeah.
If you want to just kind of see me in action, there's stuff from a lot of the Gaither videos that I've been in. And
make sure and play the Denomination Blues.
Yeah, that was a fun one.
Oh, man.
That's also on this project. That was a... Yeah. That's one of those that I get. I get as much hate mail as encouragement on that.
Oh, really?
Not really hate mail. I do. It's so funny. I mean, I took this old song by Washington Phillips. He was an old blues guy in the 20s, and he was actually, you know, mad about all the denominational rancor out there.
Yeah.
And so I took it and wrote a bunch of different verses, you know, for the groups I was familiar with.
Right,
know,
yeah, so yeah.
It was Catholics and the Presbyterians and the Nazarenes. And,
yeah, right.
And made fun of them, you know. The whole thing is satirical, tongue-in-cheek and everything, and people will call up and, I mean, a lot of them say, oh, I love that Denomination Blues. Now, right now, if they're Presbyterian, they'll want to take issue with me on that Presbyterian verse. Well, oh, but they love the way I slammed the Baptist, you know.
If it makes you feel any better, I hear preachers exegeting on Jesus hyperbole all the time. Yeah. So evidently, Jesus sarcasm is also inexplicable. So
yeah,
there you
exactly.
go.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, so go check it out. Get some more Buddy Green there. And was there any other places you wanted to mention?
That's about it. I'm not
all
widely
right.
distributed, no. But they can definitely find it there.
All right.
Okay, well, very good. And if you want to contact us to get us some letters, we love letters, hearing stories, hearing questions. Go to samsonpodcast@gmail.com. That is the new address, samsonpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can send a physical piece of paper to...
P.O. Box 224, Franklin, Tennessee, 37065.
All right.
That's it, yeah.
Well, it's been a great show, buddy. I can't thank you enough for being with us here.
Thanks, Nate.
It's been great visiting.
Great to be here.
And
thanks, Aaron. Good meeting you this way.
Good to meet you, buddy.
To all those pirate monks and chick monks out there, we will see you again next week on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Well, now I want to tell you people, it's a natural fact. Every man don't understand the Bible alike, and that's all. Well, I tell you, that's all. But you better have Jesus. I tell you, that's all. Now, denominations have no right to fight. You know they ought to go on and treat each other right, and that's all. Well, I tell you, that's all. But you better have Jesus. Well, I tell you, that's all. Oh, now it's hard to find a Presbyterian on his knees. He's too busy dotting I's and crossing all his T's, and that's all. I tell you, that's all. But you better have Jesus. Well, I tell you, that's all. And not a Pentecostal say you gotta speak in tongues. Ones, and that's all. I tell you, that's all. But you better have Jesus. Well, I tell you, that's all. Oh, somebody play now. Song, and that's all. I tell you, that's all. But you better have Jesus. I tell you, that's all. Now the Nazarenes say drinking is a crime, but I know a Nazarene who turned water into wine, and that's all. I tell you, that's all. But you better have. Where three or four are gathered, you can bet there's a fifth, and that's all. I tell you, that's all. But you better have Jesus. Well, I tell you, that's all. I'll break it down now. You better have Jesus. Well, I tell you, that's all. And now the Southern Baptists split with their brothers in the North, cause they couldn't agree on what a slave was worth, and that's all. I tell you, that's all. But you better have Jesus. I tell you, that's all. Not a Unitarian, he cutting it close. You could say that he believes in one God at the most, and that's all. I tell you, that's all. But you better have Jesus. Well, I tell you, that's all. Oh, now you can go to your college and you can go to your school, but if you ain't got Jesus, you's uneducated, and that's all. Well, I tell you, that's all. But you better have Jesus. Well, I tell you, that's all.